Hello and welcome to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. I'm here with the South Wing of the WFPL Newsroom, Devin Katayama and Erica Peterson. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be here.
Thanks, Gabe.
All right, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 502-814-8255. Going to be talking about a variety of issues around the city and dealing with the environment this week. Devin, I want to start with you. A consulting firm has made recommendations to the Louisville Metro Council to increase transparency in discretionary spending.
Yeah, and the Mountjoy Chilton Medley is the auditing firm that was hired for about $10,000 to come in. And this is coming from reports of questionable spending in the council members' accounts. And there's several accounts that council members have with this discretionary funds. And they get about $200,000 or just over $200,000 to work with these funds that kind of help their districts out.
Yeah, this is something that Louisville is a little bit unique in for a city its size and getting these funds for the council members. But why did they decide to go to an auditing firm for this?
Well, they figured it would be a very transparent process. It's not going to be, you know, a party line kind of thing that's going on. So this outside auditing agency really has a good reputation for doing these kinds of things. And they came back with a number of different recommendations that the council can do. And in fact, they said that other cities have had similar problems with this kind of transparency. But they came back with a number of recommendations that the council may be implementing in the near future.
And we can go over some of the issues that they've been having with, first of all, with discretionary spending. There have been a number of reports that this money maybe wasn't used for the most appropriate purposes. I think the biggest story was most likely the removal trial of Councilwoman Judy Green of the 1st District, who there had been findings and allegations that she had misused a lot of her city funds. But then there's a lot of things that aren't probably necessarily against any rules,
right,
but that raise some questions. Various news outlets, the Courier-Journal did some reporting on this. Philip has done some reporting on this, and you've done some.
Yeah, some spending like food for constituents in the district or even paraphernalia with council members' names on them to kind of, I don't know, hand out to people in the district. But that kind of just comes back to the whole ethical question of, is that the right thing to do with taxpayers' money? You know, promoting yourself essentially in your own district. That's what's questionable.
And there's a lot of criticism usually around election time as well. We always hear that people in the public and certainly opponents of incumbent Metro Council members start to question the spending, especially buying things, you know, backpacks, hats, T-shirts with council members' names on them and all that. But what were some of the recommendations that the auditing firm put out?
Well, the auditing firm found that a lot of the policies and procedures haven't really been looked over for a number of years, in some cases at all. For example, there's a video that the Appropriations Committee has, like half-hour video that's available that they can review for kind of ethical training in a way that a lot of the people on that committee didn't even know existed. So some of the recommendations are to just utilize some of the things that already exist. They also recommend that training happens for both staff and council members in the sense of maybe every other year there's a training that just they go through so that they know what is, you know, ethical spending and what's right and what's wrong. Other things that they mentioned is just more paperwork, essentially. And in some cases, some council members were kind of not really on board with that as much, but they were explaining how this additional paperwork will just show that the council is being more transparent. For example, at one point they said, well, you know, we tell the Office of Management Budget or Budget Management that we're giving them this amount of money for this project, and that should be good enough. But then the auditors are saying, well, you should keep your own records. So they're essentially saying that, well, the office will just send them back an email just saying, you know, you did give this to us. So stuff like that is still being worked out. So I wouldn't be surprised if some recommendations were taken and some were kind of left.
And Kroger cards, the Kroger credit cards that the council members get, those have been fairly controversial too. Did that come up at all?
That did come up. It was one of the more interesting issues. Essentially, every council member gets this Kroger credit card, and several council members do not use the card at all. Several and other council members say that it's really important that they have access to this kind of credit and credit card. So that did come up, and that will probably be something Kevin Kramer, who's the co-chair of that committee, was saying that that's probably something that'll stay, the credit cards, but it'll definitely be something that they discuss and watch closely as you know, these recommendations get laid out.
And what's next?
Next, they're going to be actually talking about a more specific issue within the recommendations, and that is the definition of public purpose. Now, this was one of the several several recommendations that they had in this report right here, but it is the most important issue because public purpose basically defines what is ethical, what they should be spending their money on, and they felt that needed a whole new meeting. So that will be taking place later this month. And I spoke with Councilwoman Tina Ward-Pugh, who is the chair of the committee, and I asked her whether it was divided along party lines or if you could point out any trends, maybe such as the Western districts might really want a credit card and Eastern districts might not. She said it was very hard to determine who might want more transparency as far as the recommendations go and who might want to just leave it a little more open. But she did mention how all council members have moved toward a more centrist approach.
What I'm sort of smiling about is that 9 years ago, the vast majority of Metro Council members had never served in public office before. And it was interesting that you saw a pretty wide gap between the two. Republicans tended to be more fiscally conservative, not understanding perhaps that there might be the need for some of these things. And then you had some Democrats, a lot from the former Board of Aldermen, who were thinking that, it's my cost center, I should be able to spend it on whatever it is I think is important to my district. And what's happened in 9 years, since the vast majority of us are still here, is that you have people on both sides. You have Republicans understanding now that there are other districts that have different needs and have different constituencies, and you have Democrats understanding that we need accountability and transparency.
And you can see right there how difficult it is for them to determine who exactly is for these things and who is not necessarily for these things. Councilman Kevin Kramer was saying that the public purpose, not debate, but meeting will be more of a philosophical meeting in people's views.
All right, and that's something we'll be following and making sure to give updates on and talking about in future States of the News episodes or installments. Erica, I want to go to you now. A Senate committee has heard testimony, they heard testimony yesterday on this proposed merger between the Federal Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and the Enforcement, Reclamation and Enforcement, and the Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah, and this the Office of Surface Mining and the Bureau of Land Management are, of course, both already under the Department of the Interior. And so what this proposed, they're calling it an integration, would do is it would basically take a lot of the administrative aspects as well as the Abandoned Mine Lands Program from the Office of Surface Mining and transfer it to the BLM.
So it essentially is a merger. They're combining these offices.
Well, it essentially is, but they are, they are making clear that the Office of Surface Mining will still be an office, and it is still going to deal with the regulatory aspects of surface mining. And their argument here is that they think leasing of land and regulatory functions shouldn't be in the same office. So they're separating that further. The BLM, of course, does a lot of leasing of lands, and they don't want to put them both under the same hat.
And how did the Senate committee receive this?
Not very well. Everyone in the committee honestly seemed to be a little bit miffed that the Ken Salazar, the Secretary of the Interior, had issued this order basically announcing their plans to explore this without consulting with Congress, which the Department of the Interior's position is that they're allowed to do it. They have the authority to do it on their own. But Congress is annoyed that they weren't consulted prior to this, and we're sort of blindsided by the announcement.
So is this a done deal then if Congress is discussing it?
Well, no, it's not. The problem is that people disagree about what the law is. The surface mine law mandates that OSM exists and it should regulate the Federal Abandoned Mine Lands Program. So in order to change that, there would need to be a change of law. But there are pretty much disagreements about whether the Interior Department can do this on their own or whether they need some sort of congressional action. And besides the Senate committee discussing this and not being too friendly towards the merger, the House Natural Resources Committee has moved formally to block it. So I guess in the coming weeks, we'll see whether this is going to go through.
Now, in that same meeting, one of the stars of that meeting was Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. He took this opportunity to lob some questions at the Office of Surface Mining Director about another issue.
Yeah, and this meeting was specifically about the merger. When Senator Paul got time for questions, he questioned Joe Pizarczyk, who's the director of OSM, about the stream buffer rule. And what that basically is in 1983, under the Reagan administration, there was a stream buffer rule that basically said you aren't allowed to dump mine waste within 100 feet of streams. And in the waning days of the Bush presidency, George W. Bush, he basically removed that. And when OSM went to try to reinstate it under President Obama, there were a lot of legal challenges, and they were basically told they have to rewrite this rule. And there have been a lot of opinions about how they've been handling that, which has not been great, probably from a PR perspective. But Rand Paul decided to question Joe Pizarczyk about this rule specifically, and he talked a lot about navigable streams, and we've got an exchange here. First, you're going to hear OSM Director Joe Pizarczyk, who Paul is questioning, and then a couple of comments by the senator.
The Surface Mining Act doesn't provide for us to conduct our activities in the context of the navigable waters.
So your jurisdiction doesn't come from the Clean Water Act?
No, sir, it does not. It comes from the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act.
This is the ridiculous notion that has allowed government to overreach, and this is what annoys us in our state. You come down here from Washington, you want to tell us every area where the water runs off the mountain is a stream, and it is not a stream. And I think it defies the intent of the law. That is the danger of you going once again into a law that took 5 years for a lot of people, Republicans, Democrats, industry, environmentalists, everybody to develop, and you're going to do a new stream rule. And yet you're really, really not talking about babbling brooks or rivers. You're talking about some low area in the land that sometimes has some water in it when it rains hard. And you hear this ridiculous notion from people saying we've destroyed 2,000 miles of stream. People think that, oh, they're polluting the Ohio River and we've disrupted the Ohio River or some major creeks or rivers. We're not talking about that at all. There is a danger to what you're doing. I will tell you that we in Kentucky don't like it. We will oppose you. We will make Congress vote on these things, and this will work across aisles. But it gets back to not whether we're for clean water or we're for clean streams. It is to do and has to do with the definition of streams.
So a couple of things there. He was very interested in, as he said, the definition of streams and this idea that that there are some areas that don't always have water in them that would be considered streams under this proposal, which it's probably worth mentioning that this proposal has not actually been proposed. It's been something that the OSM has been working on, hasn't been formally released. So there's nothing specifically for Senator Paul to oppose right now. His contention is that that the 2,000 miles of streams that environmental groups in particular like to talk about being destroyed by mountaintop removal is not exactly accurate, because they're talking about potential streams, from what I've seen of mountaintop removal, I haven't counted all the miles of streams, but some of those streams are actual streams. So I guess we'll see where this goes and how Senator Paul feels about it.
All right, and we'll add some extra details on that and a link to the story you did to the show notes when we post this online to WFPL.org. Devin, I want to go back to you. Occupy Louisville demonstrators that were active this week. They joined a national protest on Thursday, this We Are the 99% protest.
This was one of Occupy Louisville's protests. It wasn't organized by the Occupy Louisville website creators or any of the organizers that you might normally hear from. It was organized by somebody from Move On, which is a civic advocacy group here in Louisville that organized it here in Louisville. When I first got there, I mean, it was cold out yesterday, so he was kind of curious about how many people might show up. Maybe only 50 showed up at 12 o'clock yesterday when it first started, and I would say probably about 100 showed up after maybe 30 minutes or so, 20 minutes. And they just met to discuss, well, first, the two-month anniversary was yesterday of the Occupy Wall Street original movement that happened in New York City, but it was also underscored by New York City Mayor Bloomberg's decision to kind of vacate or force the occupiers in Zuccotti Park in New York City out of their location. But they did mention several of the, arguments or discussions that have been brought up
during this whole Occupy movement, which is inequality. Several people spoke who either lost their, they have owed tons of money in college debt, or they lost their job. So it was really just to honor the 2-month anniversary and to kind of just say we're still here.
And you talk about Mayor Bloomberg evicting the protesters from Zuccotti Park. Has there been anything like that here, any of these clashes with the law, clashes with police?
There haven't been clashes like other places like Portland or Oakland or New York. There haven't been those. For the most part, the occupiers, the demonstrators, have said that the relationship with Metro government has been really nice, has been good. They've allowed them to have permits in both locations that they've asked for. Now they're obviously in Founders Square, and they're spending the night there. They can have their tents up 24 hours a day, which they have had. And for the most part, they seem to have a good relationship with Metro government.
Interesting. And are they still going back to Jefferson Square Park at all?
It doesn't sound like they're going to be going back to Jefferson Square Park. It seems like they're pretty set at Founders Square. It's an area where they can have their tents up all the time, which was a big issue. And just moving all that equipment. I mean, they were getting help from the unions. I think the UAW was helping them move at one point. They had a huge truck out during the initial move over to Founders Square. But just that whole process, they've done it a few times. Initially, when the process first started, they were over in the
Belvedere,
area.
Agon Plaza. They were moving
right,
back and forth.
Right. I think they're just tired of moving. And they seem to, the people that actually inhabit the area want to stay there.
And one reason they moved out of Jefferson Square Park, that was because Light Up Louisville was coming. Their permit allowed them, to leave just for that day and they could come back?
Yeah, they would leave during that weekend, I believe come back that Monday. And it also asked them to accommodate other events that might want a permit for Jefferson Square Park. And I think talking to some of the demonstrators, they said that there were other events that were likely to come by the end of the year. So it just sounded like an easier option for them to stay.
And one quick note for anybody listening, Jefferson Square Park, that's at 6th and Jefferson Streets next to City Hall and Metro Hall. Founders Square, just a couple blocks away there at 5th and Muhammad Ali Boulevard, a little bit to the southwest, just for anybody who may be tracking that. And Devin, one last thing. We heard from the mayor. There might be some snow coming.
There may be some snow coming.
Might. Later this year, if all goes according to trends, there will be some snow.
Yes, and it sounds like we will be ready. That's the good news. Everybody likes to hear that we're ready for snow because there have been problems way in the past.
1994,
there were some problems. But I've been around several other large metropolitan areas that haven't been prepared for snow because they don't normally get it. And they've had similar issues with just snow equipment, removal equipment, and stuff like that. But it seems like Mayor Fischer has a set plan. Part of that involves some social media. There's a new Twitter feed, Lou Snow Plow, that you can follow to get updates. Also, the Metro Public Works Facebook page you can get updates on. They're actually going to overnight shifts for some of the employees instead of having them respond from on call from their homes. So that'll cut down on some of the time that they'll have to help remove some of the snow. But yeah, so I it sounds like we're ready.
And I have to assume they'll be using the new alert system to deal with snow as well. Perhaps?
That's right. Yeah.
The code red alert. Yeah.
I know. I got a call, what was it, Monday for heavy rain?
Yeah, heavy rain.
Yep.
although I got the call once it started raining.
Oh, I got the call twice.
Oh.
So.
Extra prepared.
Yeah, I guess so. I was already inside, so I was good.
See, it seems like it's already starting to work.
All right. Well, great. You could send us a comment on Twitter. We're at WFPL News. You can also find us on Facebook. We're going to be talking about Ford and the Louisville Orchestra in just a minute. You can give us a call to weigh in on that, 502-814-8255. Devin, stick around. We'll be talking with you. Erica, we'll see you later in the hour. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. We're going to be talking about Ford and the Louisville Orchestra this segment. To join us, give us a call at 502-814-8255. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're WFPL News. And I'm here with WFPL's Devin Katayama, and we're joined via phone by Jerry Downs from the Courier-Journal. Jerry, you're in L.A. right now for the auto show, and there was some big news from Ford this week.
There is first need to know it's cold and cloudy in L.A. Just
really?
Get that out of the way. But, Ford debuted the new Escape SUV in L.A. California is a really important market for Ford, and it could be the Escape's moment in the land of BMWs and Porsches and Lexuses out here. The magic number is 30 for 20, and that's 30 miles per gallon for about $20,000 or less, and that is the value edge. that Escape is going to have over the RAV4 and the CR-V, both of which critics say looks kind of boring compared to the new Escape.
Well, what are critics saying also about the new Escape, aside from that comparison? How's the reaction been to it?
It's been really positive, and if you go on CourierJournal.com, I put up a photo gallery yesterday of the current model year Escape and the new one, and view for view, it's really stunning. This new Escape is different on the inside. Instead of the plastic dash and the horizontal bench-style seating, you've got really clever and assiduous attention to detail. Soft interiors. Ford's invested for the first time in this value segment in kind of a padded dash, padded interior panels. If you've been inside Escape, you know how durable and utilitarian and plastic it is. This is an entirely different vehicle. Plus the technology, the interactive voice-controlled climate, navigation, and entertainment system.
Now, Jerry, SUVs have been kind of making, not a comeback, but they've been doing really well in the market, selling at some, in some cases, the Ford Escape has been selling at a record high. Is there any indication that this will continue? Obviously, critics are saying the RAV4 and the CR-V may look mediocre compared to the Escape, but any kind of ideas about how this will sell once we start getting people into the Louisville assembly plant?
Well, Ford's pledged to keep the pricing on the Escape low, and that's been the real secret sauce. I mean, it's a boring vehicle, it's an outgoing model year, but it's sold 2 million to date in its lifetime, and it's going to go over 200,000. How does that happen? That happens in an economy where you still have 10% unemployment, but people's vehicles are wearing out. And, you know, everybody loves to get into a 40 mile per gallon Focus or a Prius, but let's face it, it's expensive and it's too small. So the Escape offers you some utility at a great price, and that's what Ford hopes to be its winning edge going into the new model year.
And the sales of the Escape, that's going to have an effect on Louisville.
Well, if this new Escape can do 200,000, that guarantees two shifts at the Louisville assembly plant. Ford is pretty optimistic they're going to do more than 300,000 annually. That gives you a third shift at the Fern Valley Road plant and total plant employment of 4,000, which makes this more of a Ford town than ever before.
And so what's the employment now? Some of this was planned, but some of this will depend on the sales. Devin, you did a little bit on this as well.
Well, let's see. You've got 1,000 guys and women laid off from the Louisville assembly plant right now. Maybe 800 coming back that were laid off 2 years ago when they went down to one shift. They're going to add about 2,000 workers. This town's going to be overflowing with new Ford workers pretty soon, not to mention the 4,000 already at Kentucky Truck. But, you know, I'll tell you what, I did not see a Super Duty or a Lincoln Navigator at this auto show, but this is not Texas. It's California, and dealers and buyers aren't here. Sorry, Kentucky Truck, aren't so interested in your vehicles.
So it sounds like the move to a smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicle has been where people have headed with the economy and just with the need for better gas mileage and things like that.
Not only that, but the good news is that auto shows are a great barometer of the economy, and folks at this show said the mood here was more upbeat than it's been in 3 or 4 years. Total auto sales in the U.S. will be about 12.3 million vehicles this year, and analysts are confident that 13.5 million vehicles will be sold in the U.S. next year. What that means is this economy continues to grind slowly, claw its way out of this recession.
And what have people been saying locally here, Devin, about the Escape and their hopes for the Escape?
Well, I know that production is set for spring. It's set to roll off the line in spring and start being in the dealer's hands in spring. So that is set to go. It seems like people are just as optimistic as before, but it's really going to depend on how well it sells, and that can only be determined by the economy and what people actually end up buying. I was talking to Jason Spraka, who's the marketing director for the new Ford Escape, and he says, you know, they constantly crunch numbers on this kind of thing. Obviously, he's with Ford, so he has that kind of perception, but he seemed very optimistic as well that this will actually sell, continue these numbers, the 200,000, as we were saying, just this year, which sets them at an all-time high.
And there was some talk about a Focus hybrid. Jerry, what's the status of that?
I'm hearing nothing about Focus. Was once considered.
I'm sorry, the Escape hybrid.
Oh, well, no. There, that's the other great story about the Escape, is there's no hybrid powertrain in this new model. You're going to have two turbocharged fuel-injected engines, which Ford expects to be class-leading in fuel economy, and then a standard 2-liter gasoline engine. But they're moving all their hybrid powertrain technology over to the new C-Max, which will come over from Europe next year.
All right. Thank you, Jerry Downs from the Courier-Journal, and thanks to WFPL's Devin Katayama for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
And I'm with Elizabeth Kramer from the Courier-Journal, an arts writer. Elizabeth, you and I have both covered the Louisville Orchestra labor dispute for quite some time. Why don't you catch us up with what's happening now?
Well, what's happening now is there's been several offers that have been put across the table to the musicians, and the musicians have also made counteroffers. The latest offer that the orchestra made to the musicians was actually talked about last Tuesday night in a very long, nearly three-hour meeting. And the orchestra sent over a written version of that last Friday. They had a Sunday deadline for that. That passed. The musicians said they needed more time because they didn't have the written version. And then they voted on Tuesday night and reported that they unanimously had voted that down. It's interesting at this point, it sounds like the musicians, Kim Tischner, who is with the negotiating committee and a violinist with the orchestra, said that they thought that this was a step in the right direction, with a lot of the language being clearer, they thought, especially when it comes to certain aspects that they had disagreed on in the past. But the orchestra said after this that this is it. We've put everything on the table. Either they accept it or they don't. And it's interesting because there's this hearing coming up, too, that you know about.
Yeah. One thing on the management giving up, though, or saying that it's all in the musicians' court, Mayor Fisher has done a little bit of work on this in helping to secure first a loan, an anonymous donation, a grant to bring in Ralph Creviso, the nationally known consultant. And he put out the statement after this last rejection from the musicians. His chief of staff, Ellen Hessen, was working with the musicians as well in the management. And the mayor says, "My administration has met multiple times with both management and musicians at the negotiation table to explore all possible settlement approaches. We were certainly hopeful that an agreement was near and are sad to hear that there are apparently irreconcilable differences between the two sides. And we still believe an orchestra is an important part of the arts and cultural fabric of the city." What's next now? If the mayor's office is taking this stance, if the management is taking that stance, what's going to happen?
Well, I know that the mayor's office is still hopeful. I know Henry Mangio, who's with the labor, what is it called?
Louisville Labor Management Committee?
Louisville Labor Management Committee, that he, you know, he's been making phone calls. I think that they really do want an agreement. I sense a lot of frustration on management's part. I think that they've been frustrated that they didn't accept the offer that was made to them straight out in May of right before their last contract ended. So, I mean, a lot of it depends on if management from the orchestra is willing to come back. But it'll be interesting, because, you know, a press release, and you got it, we mm-hmm. both got it, came out this morning that the musicians are planning to appear with other union officials at the opening of The Marriage of Figaro tonight at the Kentucky Opera, which the orchestra is not playing at because it's on hiatus and other
right.
details involved with that.
And the opera will be using two pianos and a harpsichord for that performance rather than the pit orchestra. They actually sent over, and it's posted on their YouTube page as well, and we link to it on WFPL.org, a sample of what it may sound like. Let's hear that. These are some clips from The Marriage of Figaro opening tonight at the Kentucky Opera with pianos. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about this court hearing coming up?
Well, what it is the orchestra, after their contract ended, they were considered unemployed, or they could be considered unemployed. That's the question that's up in the air right now. They filed for unemployment. They've been getting money on those claims since then. The orchestra management is claiming that they are on strike. The musicians say they're in a lockout. The hearing actually had started and was in the middle, and there's been several dates that have been postponed. Lately, it's been the last postponement has been until December 2nd, and the orchestra is saying, you know, they're on strike, they don't deserve this money, and if the decision says that, yes, they don't deserve this money, then they will have to pay everything back that they have taken from unemployment since they filed in probably June.
And we'll be keeping an eye on that for sure, and checking in with you on that. And what will this, or what's the feeling in the community? When we post stories now on our website about the orchestra, or just when people are talking out of the building, I'll hear from people, and it seems like there's some fatigue of the back and forth, that a lot of people just in the community who maybe supported the orchestra or were casual orchestra fans are getting tired of just hearing about the back and forth of there not being an agreement. And Robert Berman, when I talked to him previously, had said that there is a risk of losing relevancy at this point.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, yeah, there is a fatigue. I mean, you definitely see it on the websites. But I talked to a couple subscribers this week, and, you know, one of them was very much adamant that this is because of unions, and that unions are the problem, and that if the unions weren't so headstrong, that we would have an orchestra here. And another person didn't really take one side or the other, but she said she just thinks it's really sad that this community wouldn't have that kind of support to fund an orchestra that we have had in the past in the first place. So some people see it as not something that's just between the musicians and the orchestra, but really a community-wide problem of where, how is this city going to support the arts? Other people have even said to me they're scared that this might be a canary in the coal mine, in the sense that other arts organizations have been struggling through this recession and continue to struggle to raise funds.
Yeah, subject to the market forces. And I'd done a little reporting on this as well. We'll put a link up to that and a link to your coverage on the website as well when we post this. Thanks a lot, Elizabeth Kramer, arts writer for the Courier-Journal.
Thank you.
All right. And when we come back, we will hear a little bit about urban industry and also the organization American Slaves, Inc. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. You may have seen a vehicle driving around Louisville advertising a publication called The Little Black Book. That vehicle belongs to Nora Shelton, founder of the group American Slaves, Inc. And I'm joined now by Michael L. Jones, who profiled ASI for this week's Leo cover story. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so ASI, this is a group that maybe a lot of people don't necessarily know about. Started about 10 years ago, right?
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about this group.
Well, Nora Shelton was, he owned a manufacturing business, and he had this epiphany that minority, being a minority contractor, he won this minority contract award, and he realized that the minority, he always thought it meant African American or black, but the people out in the audience were women, white women, and, you know, different nationalities. And so he started the search for his identity, and he realized that he should be called descendants of American slaves. So he started this organization, American Slaves, Inc., and he is trying to have descendants of American slaves recognized as a minority group.
Rather than using the term African-American or black.
Yes, because African-American, he says, should be, it's an immigration term, and it should apply to Africans who are newly in this country.
And what drove you to write about this group?
Well, I work at the Portland Library, and so every day I go down 21st Street, and their church is at 21st and Jefferson. And it's called the First Church of American Slaves. So as soon as you see that name, it catches your eyes. And there's a sign outside, and it says slave reparations apply inside. And being African American, I wanted to get my name on the list just in case. And so I walked in, and I met the people there, and I spent like 2 months just following them around.
And what were some of the things you learned that were most surprising to you?
Well, first of all, that there were white members.
Yeah, that's something you point out. Was it the first time you went in the church? There was a white man there.
Yeah, there was a lawyer there, William Warner, and when you hear First Church of American Slaves and the slave reparations, you get a certain stereotype in your head. And Shelton, he's a businessman, and I think that he speaks a language that appeals to the business community, whether they're black or white. And so he's got like a following among some white businessmen.
And yeah, two on the board, right?
Yes.
The group. And so what are some of the other key objectives of the group?
Well, ultimately, he would like to be the representative of all descendants of American slaves in America, and have companies that profited from slavery, have them pay money to his group. But for him, reparations is economic training and capital for businesses. He doesn't want to give every African American a check. But he says that, releasing slaves into a capitalist society without capital was like putting a baby in prison, and the African Americans never had a level playing field that they can compete on.
And how is the progress toward achieving these goals?
Well, America's Little Black Book, his book, is attracting a lot of people, like discussion groups. A lot of people I talked to said that they had read the book. And there are some church groups that are becoming members of ASI.
And you write about one contradiction here is that Norris Shelton is not really a religious man.
Yeah, to him, it's all about like what he calls the American slave movement. But I think in the 2 months I followed him, he mentioned three different churches that were his church. And basically, black people, are religious. I think there's a Pew study that 86% of African Americans see themselves as religious. And so he said you can't get people to go to a Descendants of American Slaves meeting, but they'll go to church.
And what's been the reaction then to some of the other African-American leaders in Louisville to this group?
Well, there have been some people who are against it. I think that the language, it's not so much as ideas, it's the language that of like just putting slavery at the forefront and blaming slavery for everything. I mentioned Gerald Neal in the article, but there were some African-American ministers that he had mentioned that he had problems with. But I wanted the article to be more of a profile of him than a back and forth with different individuals.
And what's next for Norris Shelton?
Well, I talked to him yesterday, and he is considering a run for a political office.
Any particular office, state or city?
It's a state office, but I don't want to steal his thunder because I think that they're going to be having like a presentation in a few weeks.
All right. Yeah, we'll keep an eye out for that and make sure to stay in touch with you as well. Michael L. Jones, thank you for being here. The author of this week's Leo cover story. Great story. Make sure to pick it up. Anybody out there listening who hasn't read it yet.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for being here. And there's a pocket of southwest Detroit where some residential neighborhoods are islands surrounded by heavy industry. Many people who live in these neighborhoods say they're suffering from health problems, and they suspect pollution from the industries is to blame. But not everyone feels they can afford to move away, and some people choose to stay for other reasons. Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams brings us the story.
A little more than 50 years ago, Dolores Leonard and her husband moved into their red brick ranch in Detroit.
And I selected it because the sun comes up in the morning over there, and I was thinking about my flowers.
They've raised their two kids here, and now they have four grandchildren and five great-grandchildren, and they all live nearby. But she says on any given day, she doesn't know what she'll smell when she steps outside.
Sometimes it's a kerosene odor. Sometimes it's a horrible stench like at a slaughterhouse. sometimes you're out in the public and people will say, well, where do you live? And you say, oh, yes, I know that area, that stench. I don't see how those people live there.
There is zip code 48217. It's a corner of southwest Detroit packed with heavy industry. There's the state's only oil refinery owned by Marathon Petroleum, the salt mine, the city's wastewater treatment plant, DTE's coal-burning power plant, Severstal Steel, and many more. Dolores Leonard grew up just a few streets over in River Rouge. She remembers asking her dad why people were covering their cars with tarps.
And he said it was because of the fallout, the pollution. Well, if they're covering their cars so that the paint pigmentation won't peel, then what happens to the person who lives and who's breathing all of this stuff?
Like Dolores Leonard, a lot of people have lived here their whole lives.
In my block, there are 17 people who have died of cancer. I don't know, I can't say it's cancer from where, because we're sandwiched between a lot of industry.
So why do these neighborhoods look like this? Rin Farley says it all dates back to the late 1800s. He's a research scientist at the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. He says a lot of raw materials and products were shipped on the Great Lakes, so it made sense for industries to locate in southwest Detroit.
And workers tended to congregate very close to where they worked, and so a lot of what you'd call working men's homes were built there.
They were built very close to factories, so people could walk to work. Farley says most of the industries in southwest Detroit were there by the time World War I began. Some factories have shut down. Others have expanded. Farley says over the decades, federal housing policies and discriminatory lending practices called redlining were used to help white families move to the suburbs and keep minorities out of the suburbs.
For a period of time, the racial practices were responsible for keeping blacks in densely settled neighborhoods in the city of Detroit, many of them close to factories.
He says redlining was made illegal in the 1970s, and many black families who could afford to move away from the factories did. These neighborhoods of southwest Detroit close to heavy industry are now racially diverse, with black, white, Latino, and Arab American families living near each other. Rin Farley says it's a mix of people who have chosen not to leave the area and those who can't afford to leave.
For the most part, it is low-income individuals and elderly individuals who've owned the house for 30, 40, 50 years and who are just not going to move out.
But this is not a community that's sitting still. They're vocal. People here call the State Department of Environmental Quality whenever they see something or smell something that seems out of place. Residents fought the expansion of the Marathon Oil Refinery and lost. The refinery expansion is underway. Dolores Leonard says she's not sure things will change, but she's also not sure she wants to leave.
I have relatives in the Rouge still. The cemetery isn't very far away. There are relatives who are buried there, and it's home.
All right. Host of the Environment Report on Michigan Radio, Rebecca Williams, joins me now from Ann Arbor. Also, WFPL Environment Reporter Erica Peterson is here. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And when people think of Detroit, I would think that industry is probably one of the top ideas, at least people maybe who haven't spent a lot of time in Detroit. But how prevalent overall is urban industry in Detroit?
Well, Detroit is a huge city, and there's industry spread throughout the city, but mostly southwest Detroit is the area that's especially packed with industry. And some of the people I talk to have neighborhoods, the neighborhoods they live in are surrounded by 40 different industries, everything from animal rendering facilities to steel plants, composting sites, you name it.
And the situation in Louisville is somewhat similar. There's a neighborhood near a coal plant. There's a neighborhood called Butchertown, which is near an abattoir, essentially one of the largest in the country, I believe, that's in an urban area. Also, some very large chemical plants in an area called Rubbertown, easily identifiable there. And there have certainly been some controversies here, and we'll get to that in a minute with you, Erica. But Rebecca, Marathon Petroleum is expanding in southwest Detroit, and they announced, is it they're offering to buy 350 homes in one neighborhood next to the refinery?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, they're offering a minimum of $40,000 plus half of what the home appraises for. And they're also offering people money to relocate and other bonuses if they sign up early. But not everybody thinks that that's enough money. And everybody seems to have kind of a price in mind for what it would take for them to move out. But also, many of the people who live in these neighborhoods are seniors. They're on fixed incomes. Many people are unemployed. And a lot of people have lived in their homes for decades, and they're just not sure they want to take on a new mortgage. So there's a lot more to the question of what it would take for people to move away and whether they really want to.
And I think that's something you see a lot. I mean, certainly here in Kentucky as well, in Appalachia, that's sort of been one of the typical, you know, things that people, no matter how bad the pollution gets, they don't want to leave, you know, their home place. I know here in Louisville, though, a bunch of people who live by the Cane Run Power Plant have said, please, you know, buy us out. We would love to leave, you know, so...
Well, these issues, are these the issues that residents have of living near the industries, the sort of issues that might inspire a company to offer these buyouts, are they ones that the government is watching out for? Are they ones the industry is watching out for? Or is it only brought up whenever the residents raise the concerns?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a mix. I mean, in Michigan, these are all regulated industries, and the State Department of Environmental Quality is the agency that's in charge of issuing permits and also the agency that's in charge of citing industries for any violations that happen. But there's kind of a twist here, and I don't know if this is similar in Louisville or not, but I interviewed a DEQ supervisor for my series, and she told me that there's something called Rule 901. This is a nuisance regulation, and it covers odor, and the DEQ can only respond if they get a complaint. So the agency really relies on residents of these neighborhoods to report to them if something smells funny or seems out of place, and it's only then that the agency can go out and investigate the source of that odor and potentially cite the company. So in some cases, they are completely dependent on the residents to let them know what's going on.
Yeah, and we have something similar here in Louisville, too, except we have an air pollution control district, which has its authority to regulate the air in Louisville, basically. And they've been using the nuisance complaints actually a lot lately. I think residents have kind of learned that that is one way that that they can get their attention by saying, you know, there's a funny smell, there's dust. And the air pollution control district here kind of has a lot of leverage where if they can prove that this smell is a nuisance to someone, regardless of whether it's dangerous or, you know, if it's impeding their quality of life, they can cite the industry and ask them to stop it.
And have there been in Detroit many illnesses reported for people living in these areas?
Yeah, it's pretty common for people to, and for years, residents here have been talking about asthma, and I have heard it cited that Detroit has the highest asthma rates of any place in the state. In terms of cancer, it's very common, as we heard in the story, for people to say, well, I know, you know, a dozen people who have died of cancer or who have cancer in my on my block. But there hasn't been formal study of that yet. The Michigan State University is just now starting to launch a cancer cluster study of the area.
Right. It seems like it would be very difficult to prove, no matter what evidence you have there, to prove that this is being that these illnesses are being caused by a nearby industry. Erica, you've reported on people who are sick living near one of the coal plants.
Yeah, and it's the same thing here. And unfortunately, the problem is a lot of times, I mean, besides the industries will deny it, but they'll point to, you know, these industries tend to be in low-income areas, and they'll point to other risk factors associated with poor health. And so I think it would take a lot of time and money to have a study where you control for a bunch of things like, you know, smoking cigarettes or unhealthy eating to actually point out that, oh, it's, you know, it's the emissions from a power plant that are causing this illness.
And what happens when the industry leaves with this land where certain toxic chemicals are possibly being handled, where there's this pollution? What happens if the company decides not to be in that facility in that area anymore? Rebecca or Erica, feel free to chime in.
Yeah. Erica, go ahead if you...
Well, I mean, there's a brownfield site. There are a bunch of brownfield sites in Louisville, but there's one. Blackleaf Chemical was manufacturing pesticides like DDT until about the 50s, and their site has been empty since the 70s. And it's a huge 29-acre site, you know, not too far from downtown. And they've recently discovered that the soil is contaminated. So now the EPA is there trying to clean it up, and they're investigating whether it's migrated to nearby homes. So I don't know. I mean, do you have anything similar to that in Detroit?
You know, I don't know offhand in Detroit, but I know that, you know, we have a number of legacy pollution sites in Michigan, specifically dioxin pollution from Dow Chemical, which is a you know, huge company here in Saginaw. And so it's something that we hear about a lot. You know, companies, there are paper mills in the Kalamazoo area that were responsible for releasing PCBs, which are known carcinogens, into the rivers around there. And these, you know, basically... It's just decades of agencies trying to get money from the companies to clean that up.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebecca Williams is host of the Environment Report on Michigan Radio. Erica Peterson is WFPL's Environment Reporter. Thanks both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks also to Devin Katayama, Jerry Downs, Elizabeth Kramer, and Michael L. Jones. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Brad Yost and Laura Ellis. For show notes and more information, visit WFPL.org. I'm Gabe Bullard.